Yo, 80 degrees at 8 a.m. is insane.
The way the sun was hitting me, you would think I offended it.
I never want to hear the old Midwestern saying of, it's not the heat, it's the humidity that will get you, ever again. 105 degrees is 105 degrees, no matter where you are.
It's like you opened an oven, it's been since the morning making a Thanksgiving turkey.
Yes.
And then somebody took a blow dryer from inside the oven.
And then put it on your face, yes.
Ridiculous.
I'm Julie Rose, and this is Top of Mind, where we tackle tough topics with nuance and an open mind. We're out to become better citizens, kinder neighbors, and more effective advocates. Summers are getting hotter throughout America. Heat waves are getting longer and more common. In June 2025, more than 100 million people across the United States experienced record-setting heat. And one in five U.S. cities now has a full extra month of hotter-than-normal summer days compared to 1970. Climate models predict these trends will continue. But even though extreme heat kills more people most years than hurricanes, floods, and tornadoes combined, we don't really treat heat like an emergency. For example, the government doesn't name heat waves the way it does storms. And the warnings that go out typically amount to, hey, it's going to be hot, so turn up the AC, stay inside, drink lots of water. But many Americans can't escape the heat because they don't have reliable AC or they can't afford to run it day and night. Or maybe they work outside. So today on Top of Mind, how do we adapt to this new, hotter normal? We'll consider who is most at risk and meet a researcher who walked right to the brink of death from heat stroke, all for the sake of science. And we'll visit the hottest city in America for a glimpse at what the future may hold for the rest of us. What exactly does it take to stay cool when Mother Nature has other ideas? You'll also hear from lots of regular folks on TikTok sounding off about the heat, so listen for this.
We're talking like record-breaking temperatures, power grids struggling to keep up, and potential health injuries, especially for senior citizens, children, or those who work outside. So if you thought last summer was rough, this is a different story.
Because heat is so difficult to quantify and set thresholds for, it's still not part of what we consider a disaster event.
Larissa Larson is a professor of urban planning at the University of Michigan, and she got interested in heat response early in her career.
I am a Canadian, and my very first teaching position was at Arizona State University. So I and my husband moved to Phoenix, and as a Canadian, I couldn't stop saying, wow, it's really hot here, and it's really dry here. It's not one of the disasters that are recognized by the Stafford Disaster Act, where FEMA will act.
Wait, so does that mean that if you have a heat wave and the electrical grid goes down or it causes infrastructural damage, people die, you have to put all these centers, cooling centers up, right? Like none of that you can get federal help for? Like FEMA won't come in and respond or offer, you can't like declare a heat disaster and then like trigger federal disaster funds.
Absolutely, you're absolutely right, because it isn't established as a disaster. I think there's something like, I don't know, around 20 causes of a disaster, but heat is not a recognized cause.
But isn't heat the most fatal of the weather-related emergencies?
It is. You're absolutely right.
It's even more fatal than winter weather, but there is a long-standing government program to help people stay warm, notes Larson.
Since 1981, there's been a federal program called the Low-Income Housing Energy Assistance Program, people call it LIHEAP, to help lower-income people, people with disabilities, afford heating. Only approximately 30 out of 50 states will allow, at this point, money to go for cooling as well as heating. And so I think shifting our mindset to see that this is as an issue as pressing as cold has been in the past is something that many people aren't kind of tuned into yet.
The irony is that we have known for a long time how deadly heat can be. The first time a heat wave really caught the attention of U.S. policymakers and the public was back in 1995.
So this was a situation where over a five-day period in Chicago, temperatures rose to 106 degrees, but with humidity, it felt like 126. What also happened is 49,000 people lost power in the city. So if you had cooling, you didn't have it anymore. Residents, in efforts to cool down, opened hydrants, and that really reduced water pressure all over the city.
Oh, right. So people just went out and like put their wrenches on those lug nuts and like opened them up and brought the water out.
And I understand why. 1,000 people went to hospital around issues of heat stroke, exhaustion, renal failure, electrolyte imbalances. And the coroner at that time estimated that 739 people died, which was over the expected amount of that week at a normal year. The CDC did some study afterwards and said that, you know, the big things, the most important preventative factors, access to air conditioning, that people with pre-existing health conditions were certainly at higher risk, that housing characteristics mattered a lot. And this is something I have been really interested in. Urban planners tend to think if we add trees, we'll solve the problem. And I am an urban planner and I love trees, but actually the building matters more. And then the last characteristic that the CDC work found was social isolation. If you were in particular neighborhoods in Chicago that where crime was high, people were worried about opening windows. Maybe they didn't have social connections as some communities would have. Your chances were much greater of dying. If you were a Black resident, it was 1.5 times a white resident. However, and this always fascinates me, Chicago at that time had a population of 23% Latino. And Latino residents, only 2% of deaths happened in that group. And it's in part believed to be that there's more sort of a tightly woven social connection. You tend to live with extended family. And so just learning, again, the importance of the sort of friendship, social ties that exist in places to check in on people when things aren't going well.
Where are we most concerned? Are planners like yourself and emergency responders, where should we be most concerned about heat in the United States today?
I think there's probably two answers. One is place-based and one is people-based. So place-based, probably in urban settings where we have a lack of trees and a lot of impervious surface. So those locations, they get hot. The concrete, the asphalt holds the heat and releases it later in the day so that nighttime cooling doesn't occur so much. And those places also tend to be where we have the oldest housing and housing that doesn't have up-to-date insulation, good systems for air conditioning, those sort of things. The other dimension, so that's the place-based. The people-based, the who, it's the elderly. It is people with disabilities. This issue that they may not have mobility and they may not, due to many of the medications, even feel the heat as effectively as some of us and therefore not act on it. A challenge, you know, much of this discussion is the challenge of understanding heat, is that many people who die because of heat, it's exacerbating an existing condition. So they were people that maybe did have cardiopulmonary disease or something else, and this is the thing that, you know, caused them, the heat hastened their death.
But it's not as easy to pin it on the heat as if it was a tornado and the house collapsed and somebody died, or a flood and someone died in the water, right? So it becomes a little harder to quantify.
You're absolutely right. And sometimes, you know, there can be, you may not die that day, but you may die a few days later. And you're absolutely right. In the codes that emergency departments use about what was the cause of death, traditionally, heat has not been one of those causes. And there's movement in the medical community to improve how we code this so we recognize it truly is a cause or an exacerbation to an existing problem.
In fact, Larson says lack of good data is a major barrier to giving heat the serious consideration that it deserves.
it's terribly difficult to get good information on this. The census asks a lot of questions, but they don't ask, do you have air conditioning? And if you have air conditioning, can you afford to use it? And is your system working? Really, we need to know at a census tract level, you know, what proportion of homes do and don't have working air conditioning and people that can afford it, so they can be the places if there has to be some emergency action where we prioritize sending buses to take people or use them as portable cooling stations, where fire department individuals, employees go and do wellness checks. I mean, it's just knowing more precisely where people are as we have more of these incidents.
So what would a heat-resilient city have?
Gosh, it would have cool roofs. So roofs of housing or buildings would be with reflective materials. Industrial buildings, you can paint them white so that it reflects up the heat. We would see that. We would see more vegetation. We would see more opportunities for cooling, like swimming pools and splash pads.
And Larson says cities would have regulations around maximum indoor temperatures, too. California, Maryland, Minnesota, Nevada, and Oregon already have heat restrictions for indoor workplaces. Larson says there should be heat rules for housing, too.
So in rental housing in the past, we would set minimum temperatures to ensure that in winter months, people, you know, wouldn't be too cold. Now we're exploring the idea of maximum temperatures and what is an appropriate maximum temperature. But there's a lot of, you know, pushback. You know, anytime you come up with a suggestion, people find concerns. And for a lot of apartment owners, property managers, they feel that this would add expense to what they do. There's the initial pushback. There's also the concern that, yeah, we can set the threshold, but who will implement it?
Or guarantee the power stays on in a heat wave?
We know that we're experiencing more power outages as a result. When everyone comes home from work and flips on that AC, it's an incredible jolt to the system. And as our infrastructure systems are getting older, we're experiencing more problems. It's really a tricky thing. I promote using air conditioning, but I also worry about climate change. And if electricity sources come from coal-based products, we worsen climate change. So this is another argument to sort of diversify the sources of energy to things that are non-fossil fuel-based. So wind, solar, maybe nuclear. We need more sources that don't contribute to climate change.
And cooling alternatives that don't actually make cities hotter, like air conditioning does.
We know that urban places are hotter because we've changed the surfaces in those places. We've reduced vegetation. There's less air circulation. And we have more waste heat. So from factories, from output from air conditioning units. All those things have combined. When we've walked around, we'll notice often a vent from a building and out pours hot air. So the cooling system is releasing that hot air to the surrounding area. And, you know, when we look for those passive solutions, like opening our window, if the outdoor temperature is not any cooler, it's not going to help us.
Larson says the best passive cooling solutions at the moment focus on keeping the heat out.
So the things that keep homes warmer in the winter often are equally helpful in higher summer temperatures. So adding insulation to walls, improving the fit of windows and doors so we don't have the waste heat exchange from indoor-outdoor. My favorite fix is actually film that can be applied to windows. This film is clear, but what it does is it reflects a lot of the solar energy that hits the window. It reflects it back outside versus going inside and creating like a greenhouse effect.
It's like putting sunglasses on your windows.
Exactly. I think we have to be more aware and more intelligent. So when we have these heat warnings, that isn't the time to go out and push your lawnmower around your yard and cut your grass. I think it's being kind of respectful of the environment a bit more than what we've done in the past. Certainly, I think there's been a move towards having access to water more, and that probably, you know, that is very important. But staying in the shade, wearing lighter clothing, not working at the height of the day, taking a break, seeing morning and evening as better work times. Probably one of my most striking experiences when I was living in Phoenix, Arizona, I went into a neighborhood. We were talking to people there, and there was a woman. It was early evening, and she lived with her family in a very modest home and without air conditioning. But what she did is fill a small child's pool of cold water, and her four or five little kids all got in and had a little bit of bath, I guess you could call it, to cool everybody down so that they could go to sleep. So I never forgot that. But again, it shows, you know, we can solve these problems. We just sometimes need to think about what we have in our homes and how we act.
Larissa Larson is a professor of urban and regional planning at the University of Michigan. She's an expert on the effects of heat in the built environment. Professor Larson, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I've enjoyed talking to you, and hopefully people will think more about heat.
Okay, now it's time to get really hot ourselves in a heat wave simulator.
Heat can sometimes creep up on us. It's sometimes you feel fine, then all of a sudden you don't feel fine.
How heat kills is next on Top of Mind from the BYU Radio Podcast Network. I'm Julie Rose. Before we get back to today's episode, I want to take just a moment to recommend another show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, The Lisa Show. Life can be stressful, but Lisa Valentine Clark, her guests, and Council of Moms provide a practical yet positive and empowering look at life's challenges. They tackle them head on, sharing experiences, offering suggestions on how we can handle things like relationships and health, technology, body image, family, and much more. It's The Lisa Show. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Mother Nature decided to turn the oven on 450 degrees outside. The heat is like covering me like a snowsuit or something. Like, it's just, I can't even catch a breeze out here.
So one reason that the government approach to emergencies has thought of winter storms as the more serious threat might be that we've taken our heat tolerance for granted. Harvard physiologist Rob Mead says going back a millennia, the human body developed a sophisticated system for regulating heat.
Though, of course, with everything, there is a limit to this response, and this is kind of what we're up against with climate change. Once you get over a certain point, a certain temperature, the kind of increase in risk accelerates much quicker in the heat. So even a small change in the temperatures that we're experiencing can have pretty large impacts on the risk of heat-related mortality.
And we know the upper limit of the human body's ability to withstand heat from some pretty gnarly experiments, like one that Mead helped to run. It lasted 9 hours.
In a laboratory chamber, 42 degrees Celsius, just I'm Canadian, so I have to convert, is 107 Fahrenheit. I think it was a heat index of about 150 or so. So quite hot.
Okay. So it felt like 150 degrees?
Yes, yeah.
And Mead volunteered as a participant as well.
You know, I can't really ask someone to do this without really understanding what it feels like myself.
So let's join Mead inside the heat chamber. There's no sun or shade, just hot, humid air. It's like walking into a sauna.
So it starts off with, you know, just the regular feeling of you're out on a hot day. You feel your hot skin. The air is thick because it's hot and it's heavy. Pretty quickly, you start sweating profusely.
Which isn't actually offering much relief because of all the humidity.
The main reason why sweat cools the body is the evaporation of sweat from the skin. So if humidity is high, that sweat can't evaporate. It just sticks on the body. You don't get any cooling. And then you also get that, you know, gross feeling that everyone's experienced where your skin is just, you feel wet and sticky.
Why, when humidity is high, does my sweat not evaporate?
If there's already a lot of moisture in the air, we can't push more moisture into it, or it becomes more difficult to moisturize the air.
It's like how humidity is measured in percent. So the higher the percentage, the less moisture the air can take in. So even though I am fanning myself like crazy right now, it's helping, but not much.
The idea with fanning is, so if you could think about you're sitting here, you're covered in sweat, and the air just above your skin is becoming humid because you're sweating directly into it. If we use a fan or some form of airflow to kind of help push more, you know, maybe the air is still humid, but it's relatively dry over the skin, this should help improve the evaporative efficiency. How much will depend on how humid and hot the air currently is. So there's a point at which, you know, it becomes too hot and humid where this fanning effect, you know, just ceases to work.
And we are getting really uncomfortable. This is not fun. I don't know about you, but I just want to get out of here.
Your brain is sending you some pretty serious alarm bells. You know, really just that feeling that you get, we often say heat is very mental. You feel lethargic, that happens, but you also get kind of agitated. Everyone responds a bit differently, but there's definitely this drive to, you know, we need to get out of this heat. We need to remove ourselves from this situation. And the hotter you get, the, you know, more prominent that kind of those requests and demands from your body become.
What's going on inside of my body? What else is happening?
At these kind of points, your body temperature is just becoming very hot. It's rising the temperature of your tissues. What your body is trying to do in addition to sweat is also push blood to the skin. And the idea here is that, you know, we need to get that heat from the core out to the surface where we can hopefully evaporate it away. 104 degrees Fahrenheit is roughly the threshold for what we call heat stroke. A very high body temperature can lead to a whole bunch of nasty effects. On one side of the coin, we have, you know, typically when that temperature, we see, you know, mental changes, cognition is affected, people can become confused. At very high temperatures, you can see seizures. Another thing that happens is because the body is trying to, again, move heat and blood to the periphery, the skin, you can have disruptions in blood flow to the gut, GI system, and that can actually cause, in addition to the heat, the kind of barrier in our gastrointestinal tract to start to loosen a little bit. And this can actually cause an endotoxic response. So you actually get endotoxins flood the bloodstream, and these can have huge effects, organ-wide system damage. You know, in heat stroke, you often see damage to the liver, damage to the heart, damage to the kidneys. Interestingly enough, heat stroke actually presents very similar to sepsis. It's kind of the closest condition to heat stroke.
And ultimately you die of organ failure. But we're not gonna stay in this chamber long enough for that. It's already been 6 hours, the point when Mead bailed out during the actual experiment.
I was pulled because I hit the threshold, though I was about ready to go anyways. But at that point, you know, you're feeling like this has gotta stop sort of thing, so.
Whew, that's better. Now, Mead says the longest that a participant lasted in that chamber was 9 hours. Scientists don't fully understand why there's such a range in when people hit the heat threshold for their body. Some of it is definitely genetics. Some is just tied to what you're used to.
We do know that the body's physiological system has a pretty amazing, actually, plasticity in adapting to warmer temperatures. There's been tons of studies done, again, in laboratory environments where you bring someone in to the lab, you then have them either, you know, exercise in the heat for a week or two, or you have them exposed to hot temperatures in a water bath and then test them again. And even within about a week's time, you can see marked improvements in, you know, how rapidly they're sweating, how much they can sweat, and actually the body temperature shifts down a little bit to lower temperatures.
In fact, there's evidence that heat is more deadly at the beginning of the summer because by the end of the season, people have had 3 months to adapt physically and adapt their behaviors.
Most of what we do thermoregulatorily is actually behavioral. You know, we can check the weather, dress appropriately, we can use air conditioning, we can use fans. On the other side of the coin is we also have people who we know are physiologically less able to, once exposed to the heat, kind of cope with it. So the big one is aging. So as we get older, our ability to dissipate heat decreases. The kind of point at which we start to sweat shifts to higher body temperatures. So to, you know, generate a certain amount of sweat, our body has to become hotter. Why exactly this occurs is not fully understood, though we do know it is probably related to just the natural decline in aerobic fitness.
So that suggests that being in better aerobic shape could actually improve a person's ability to respond to heat as they age.
We've done studies where, for example, we compared the age-related changes in thermoregulatory function in people who were, you know, highly fit masters athletes to still active but more sedentary individuals. And we saw basically that age-related decline was almost completely ameliorated in the more fit individuals.
So being physically active helps with heat resistance, but being physically active in the heat, not so much, says Mead.
At any given time, when we're just sitting here talking, we're producing about as much heat as a light bulb. When we become physically active and our muscles are now demanding a ton of energy to use to support physical work, whether we're running, whether we're, you know, working in the garden, this increase in metabolism will directly increase heat production.
Okay. So if you and I sitting in that heat chamber were also jogging up and down, then we would likely reach the threshold, the danger threshold, and have to be removed more quickly. Because we're adding to the heat.
Exactly.
And can you reverse back out of that? Or damage has already been done and it's just a matter of, can your body recover if you can cool it down?
The quicker you can cool someone from those kind of temperatures, the better off they're going to be. And certainly you have people who, particularly you see it in road races, like marathons, sporting events, who get heat stroke due to, you know, extreme physical activity, who are cooled immediately, then brought to hospital and have very good outcomes thereafter, very little lasting impacts of that event. So the best way to protect someone from the heat is to give them access to a cooled environment. There's a whole field of research right now that is kind of centered around the identification and evaluation of what we would call sustainable cooling strategies. So for an example, like let's say it's 95 degrees Fahrenheit outside and I want to keep my home cool. I could set my air conditioner to 72 Fahrenheit and let it run and everyone's going to be comfortable. Alternatively, I could crank up the set point, you know, maybe 4 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit, and then use a fan to help circulate the air. And then another thing that's often recommended, you know, is, and this is actually what I do at home, is I pay close attention. I have, as you might imagine, I have a couple indoor temperature sensors, but I pay close attention to the temperature of my living room and then how that's different from outside. So when I get up and I go to leave for work in the morning, I shut all the windows, close all the blinds. But the second, you know, the outdoor temperature dips below the indoor temperature, I open everything up, try to use fans and actually help draw cool air in from the outside. Now, that said, my personal view, and I think where the evidence stands currently, is that we don't want to be relying on these strategies alone during a heat wave. There's a limit to their effectiveness. Heat can sometimes creep up on us. It's sometimes you feel fine, then all of a sudden you don't feel fine. So you really want to be proactive about seeking cooling, keeping yourself cool. It also is important to, you know, reach out to loved ones, establish a network. We know actually that having a solid support system is very protective during heat waves.
Rob Mead is a research fellow at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Salata Institute for Climate and Sustainability. By 2050, most areas in the United States will likely have an extra month of over 90 degree temperatures. But in Phoenix, Arizona during the summer, 90 degrees is often the low temp.
In the last 2 years, we saw over 100 days of where our lowest temperature was 90 degrees. So people are just not able to escape the heat.
But the city's groundbreaking heat response team has found some solutions. We'll get advice from the nation's hottest city coming up next on Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This is the BYU Radio Podcast Network. Hey friends, if you are looking for another great show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, check out Constant Wonder. Host Marcus Smith takes you on an exhilarating journey through captivating stories of our magnificent natural world. You'll gain profound insight into different facets of our planet, discover more about nature, and maybe even ponder your connection to Earth's wonder. The show is Constant Wonder, and you can find it wherever you get your podcasts.
If it's going to be hotter than this summer, I don't want it. I don't want it.
I'm Michelle Litwin. I am the Heat Response Program Manager out of our Office of Heat Response and Mitigation.
What are things like today in Phoenix? As I'm speaking to you, it's early to mid-July, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
It's nice and toasty here in Phoenix today.
I was just looking up online just because I was curious. So it looks like there's an extreme heat warning going on. looking for a high of 113 degrees.
Mm-hmm. 113 doesn't shock me anymore. I never thought I would say that. 113 seems fine to me, but as soon as I see 120, that's when I start freaking out.
Phoenix was the first city in the United States to create a department solely focused on heat. Maricopa County hit a sobering milestone back in 2019, nearly 200 heat-related deaths in a single year. It was a new high.
There were a lot of conversations happening. Our local sort of universities here were really able to sit down with our mayor and get her excited about heat and how dangerous it is. We also had a couple of committees that were happening at that time at the city, and they really wanted to see some more movement on tree shade.
And there were some smaller heat-related projects going on in Phoenix at the time. Litwin was working on one.
We had just won a Bloomberg Challenge for heat-ready cities, and it was off of a little initiative called We're Cool. And the idea was that we would hand out water at some of our transit platforms. So we know that, like, walking to and from the light rail or your public transportation aspect may or may not have shade, and so they were at higher risk. And so that's where it kind of all started.
But by 2021, it was clear that Phoenix needed to go much bigger.
And city mayor and leadership council members voted unanimously to create our office. It has been so exciting to just watch this growth of what this little program Work Cool was into a full-fledged office here at the city of Phoenix. The heat response side, which I focus on, is sort of our, I hate to say short-term strategies, but they are our day-to-day strategies. How are we going to keep you alive today? And so that might be a cool space. That might be providing AC assistance or connecting you with a utility assistant program. And then we do have program managers on our mitigation side, and that's our longer term strategies, built infrastructure, right? Like, what materials are we using to build? Cool pavement, more shade structures, whether that be trees or man-made. So we really do see our work holistically from day to day to our longer term strategies.
The Heat Response and Mitigation Office started up with a budget of almost $3 million and a steep learning curve.
2023, we saw one of the largest spikes in heat-related deaths that we had seen. I mean, any death is too many, and that's really what we believe. And so we were, unfortunately, year over year, seeing a steady incline in heat-related illnesses and heat-related deaths. And in the last 2 years, it was above 600. Over 600 people in Maricopa County had experienced a heat-related death.
Even with all the work that you're doing.
So I will say, I'm not using this as a hooray, we've solved it. Last year was the first year that we have seen a decrease in heat-related deaths in over a decade. I'm not saying we are done, we're not even close, but to see that decrease when we are trying out these new, very innovative ideas, we're running with it. We're saying, hey, this is working, let's increase what we're doing.
Right from the start, Litwin says their efforts were driven by data. For example, they noticed a lot of 911 calls related to heat coming from lower income areas of the city.
It could be those who are living paycheck to paycheck. And so running your air conditioning unit all day is just not an option.
So Phoenix opened cooling centers all across the city.
All 17 library branches act as cooling centers. So during normal business hours, you can go in there, get a cool space, rest. We do stock our cooling centers with heat relief supplies as well. So if you go in there and you want that cooling towel or hat or sunscreen, you can get that along with your cold bottle of water. So we're seeing lots of kids in there. We're seeing job seekers in there. We are seeing those who wanted to give their AC a rest. So they'll come take full advantage of the libraries.
As the team continued to check the data, they noticed another pattern.
What we were really seeing in the years leading up to 2024 were high number of 911 calls between like 5 and 6 o'clock at night. And that's because, hey, our cooling centers are closing, right? They were just typical hours. And so we really use that information to go to city leadership and say, hey, we've got to address this. We're seeing way too many high 911 calls regarding heat after typical business hours. And it's in these hot pockets around where we've now implemented our extended hours. And thankfully, you know, our city leadership has been so supportive of our office, and they were like, let's go try this. And so Harman Yucca and Cholla Library were selected using a lot of different data sets, and they stay open until 10 p.m. What's really great about this year is not only do they stay open until 10 p.m. as a cooling center, they stay open as a library until 10 p.m. So regardless as if you're, you know, our kids are going back to school the next week or so, they can go in there and pull books out, use the computers, any library service. Or if you just want that cool space, you can go in there and get it too.
And for those who need access to cool spaces even outside of those hours, Phoenix has a respite center.
In the respite center, you can sleep. You can close your eyes. You can stay there for 24/7, multiple days. You could be there all week. You could be there for a month. Obviously, we hope that's not happening. We are providing with navigation services. We've got a local organization who's there to provide additional resources like housing, help with finding jobs, things like that.
Is it like a Red Cross center that you'd see? Is it like a almost like a homeless shelter type setup with like cots and like? What's the deal?
So it's not a shelter. We have to be very careful not to call it a shelter. We can't have bedding in there because of zoning, but we do have tables and we do have chairs in there. We have certain segments for women. We have a family zone that only if you're a part of a family can you go in. So it's got a lot of different pockets for people. We do have an outdoor area if you've got your pet with you, and we've got an area for caseworkers to work one-on-one with those who are in there in sort of a more private setting. So yeah, it's just like a big warehouse sort of situation that we've been able to tailor to our needs.
Who is most at risk of a heat-related death in Phoenix?
So those who are experiencing homelessness are going to be our highest risk population. In 2023, we did have a large semi-permanent sort of area of those experiencing homelessness, anywhere between 700 to 800 people at any given time were in this area in downtown Phoenix. And we were doing our outreach down there, but as we were down there, we were really finding out people, that was their home. They didn't want to leave their things. They didn't want to leave their home to go to a cooling center, even if it was just a mile away. And so we really got together as a city and said, what can we do? They weren't going to this little pop-up tent that we had established the year before. And so we were really grateful that our transit department was able to offer us one of their buses for the summer. And we put it right in the middle. We put it right in the middle of where we were seeing the semi-permanent encampment. That way, people were always within reach of their homes, in reach of their items and their things and their familiar, right? We did have security on the bus. That bus was full all day, every day. And I think was really life-saving. Since then, we don't see that large number of homeless living in that area anymore. So we don't really need that technique there anymore. So we're constantly having to adapt our sort of mindset on how we're going to respond. We are actively trying to reach everybody. And so that is including those who are experiencing homelessness, that it does include those in mobile homes, low socioeconomic situations, and our senior populations. I even have a youth heat safety workbook that I've created to try and educate the kiddos on how to stay safe during the summer months.
They also target athletes, visitors, and hikers.
We're seeing a lot of 911 calls at our trailheads, and we really wanted to try and understand what's going on there. So we have this whole Take a Hike, Do It Right program that comes from our Parks Department. And then I sort of came in and I was like, well, we have this community emergency response team. They're volunteer groups that's focused on this thing. Let's bring them in as educators. So we go out on weekends, Saturdays and Sundays, to our most visited trailheads, and they're there with water, they're there with emergency cooling towels, and really just that information piece. I empower my volunteers to scare people off those mountains. If you see someone coming in flip-flops and they've got the single-use plastic water bottle that they've already started drinking, Echo Canyon is just not the hike for them. I'm encouraging my volunteers to say, hey, like, this is a really hard hike. There's not a lot of shade. We're already seeing this temperature. I really recommend you maybe try again. Or once you're halfway through your water bottle, that's your turnaround point. So it really is about keeping everyone safe. And that's why we are out there at the trailheads trying to promote that education.
Phoenix is also one of the few cities in the country with an indoor cooling ordinance.
There are landlord-tenant protections. We do actively highlight those programs. If you're having issues with your landlord because they're not keeping it at a temperature that's safe, then our neighborhood services department does have people who can help you with that.
And during the summer, the Phoenix Office of Heat Response and Mitigation publishes a weekly public report with exactly how many people came to cooling centers, how many heat-related calls for service came in, how many heat-related deaths there were, and a lot more. It's a level of transparency, honestly, that really surprised me. But Litwin says tracking and reporting data like that is the only way to succeed. And that's exactly what she tells other cities who call asking for advice.
I think it's just really trying to find your data set that you want to use, whether that's your 911 calls around heat, working closely with your public health departments, and understanding what your need is. If you're a city that's old, like Chicago or New York, I know they have a lot of infrastructure issues. And so how do you address that? Is it temporary AC units through a local nonprofit or something like that? So I think you really got to understand your population of need. We've been really lucky to have city management on our side, have a council and mayor who are super supportive and see that this is an issue. And there might be different ways to attack that and be ready for it to change. You have to be adaptable, be very flexible.
Michelle Litwin is the Heat Response Program Manager for the Phoenix Office of Heat Response and Mitigation.
Bring an umbrella to protect yourself from the sun. Like, there's no shade in this park.
It's like 90 degrees over here. We're going in the pool.
I would literally be passed out on the floor somewhere near the boardwalk if it wasn't for the fact that I knew this car had AC.
Amen to that. Thank goodness for car AC. So how's the heat been where you live? How do you keep cool all year long? And did anything you heard today make you think differently about who's at risk or what we should be doing to keep people safe? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Email topofmind@byu.edu. We've also listed all the TikTok accounts you heard in today's show notes, so be sure to check those out. Top of Mind is a BYU radio podcast. Today's episode was produced by Isabella Sosa and Taya Wolf with help from Abby Karras, Samuel Benson, Sam Payne, and me. Our sound engineers are Lauren Sandberg and Hayden Thompson. I'm Julie Rose. Stay cool, and we'll talk soon.